What you're about to hear was recorded at the Pen on Fire Speaker Series in Salon on Tuesday, February 23rd, 2021. Tonight with literary agent Betsy Amster. She's a former editor at Random House and has been described in the LA Times as the dogged prospector of the city's literary talent. Her clients include bestselling novelist Maricel Vera, Maria Amparo Escandon, and Joy Nicholson, MacArthur Fellow and urban farmer Will Allen, Beard Award winner Kim Boyce, popular historian Margaret Leslie Davis, and bestselling research psychologist Elaine Aaron. And I think I've known Betsy for about 20 years, and I can say she's one of the most honest, ethical, and smart agents you will ever meet. So welcome, Betsy.
Thank you so much.
Glad to see you again. So let's start by talking about how you got started on the West Coast being an agent.
When my husband was recruited by USC, I knew I wanted to stay involved in publishing. I really didn't know what the West Coast landscape was going to be like. I worked ever so briefly at a small publisher in Century City that I began to call Hypochondriacs Press. It was a health book publisher. And that was too narrow. And after a few months, I ended up leaving that job. And at around the same time, an agent I had worked with in New York called me up and said, would you like to work together? You be the development end on the West Coast. You look for authors out there. It's an amazing literary landscape, but I'm here on the East Coast and I can help you sell those books. And so it was a great kind of apprenticeship for me. The agent's name was Angela Miller, and I learned a great deal from her about negotiating contracts and sort of dealing with editors. I had dealt with authors as an editor. It's very different being an agent. There's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. When you're an editor at a large company, you can kind of step behind the company and say, well, they won't let me. And it's a much more direct relationship, really, as an agent with your clients. And so that was very eye-opening. And after a couple of years, I ended up feeling that I liked the whole arc of the enterprise, from development to sales. And so I went out on my own, and I've been doing it ever since.
So when you started agenting out here, it seems like the West Coast was regarded as a sort of wasteland for authors, right? I mean, it was, everybody wanted a New York agent. And there were a few agents, you, Sandy Dykstra, BJ Robbins, there were a few of you here, but it's quite different now.
I think it is really different now. I never felt that handicapped, I think because I had spent so much time in New York. And so I could present myself as somebody who spoke their language. And BJ as well. That was really helpful. I think that there was a kind of stereotyped view of LA as very woo-woo, very shallow. I did have people say annoying things to me about being based in LA as opposed to San Francisco. One of the hot early high points for me was going to a writer's conference at Book Passage. It was a travel writer's conference. And Jan Morris, the amazing travel writer, was there. And the attendees were kind of preening about San Francisco. And she said, well, there's less to it than meets the eye, but LA, on the other hand, is a world-class city. And that happened very early. And that solved my problem, if you understand what I mean. It's like, I'm not going to worry about this anymore. This city's been blessed by Jan Morris.
So talk about what you represent and if it's changed since when you began.
You know, I was thinking about that today. It hasn't actually changed that much. I love representing, I'm going to try to do some show and tell. We'll see how well this works. I really like literary fiction. Marisol's book, The Taste of Sugar, came out to incredible reviews over the summer. Everybody was worried about publishing books sort of, you know, into the heart of the pandemic, and LiveWrite, which is part of Norton, didn't want to postpone it. And it turned out to be a really good thing because it got a lot of review attention. I think it was really advantageous that it came out when it did. A long time ago, one of my first books was The Tribes of Palos Verdes. This is the movie tie-in edition by Joy Nicholson. And I found her in a literary magazine that was distributed in my old neighborhood of Silver Lake. I mean, it was just this incredibly local effort. I like narrative nonfiction. My author, Margaret Leslie Davis, author of The Lost Gutenberg, she follows one Gutenberg Bible from inception all the way through into Estelle Doheny's hands, actually, and Angelino, and beyond. I like cookbooks. Here's a book on pairing cheese with beer, wine, and cider. Here's a book called What Makes a Wine Worth Drinking. I really like research-based self-help because it kind of underwrites some of the other things that I do. My author, Elaine Aaron, is known for her work on the trait of high sensitivity. Came out, her most recent book is The Highly Sensitive Parent. Her books have sold millions of copies worldwide, which is fantastic. Did a book recently called Sugar Proof, which is about really understanding how much sugar there is in kids' diets. I have a little subspecialty in charming gift books, good bugs for your garden, illustrated. I like oddball books. And then sort of current events. Here's a book by my author, Christopher Knoxon, Good Trouble, Lessons from the Civil Rights Playbook. Again, Abrams published it. They're an illustrated book publisher. The typeface, the font is made out of his handwriting, and then it's illustrated with his illustrations. So that gives you a sense of my range. Every agent has a pretty broad range because this is a business for generalists. That's one of the great things about it. We get to follow up on our interests. We get to develop new interests. So that's all really fun.
So you, a few minutes ago, you said that self-help underwrites other projects. Can you say a bit more about that?
Well, especially research-based self-help, if authors have the kind of credentials that are attractive to publishers, the publishers are willing to pay quite a bit of money for them. On the other hand, with literary fiction, you may do very well, or you may have a very modest advance from a smaller publisher. One of the luxuries of being an agent is if you want to operate this way, you can represent the things that you love. I find that I'm most effective when I take on projects that I feel really enthusiastic about. What I'm doing is selling my enthusiasm to the publishers. So not everything I take on is going to make $1 zillion. And yet I want the freedom to be able to take it on and really support it. There's sometimes an inverse relationship actually between how saleable something is and, well, no, not an inverse relationship, a direct relationship. If it's very saleable, it goes for a lot of money. If it's not saleable, it's, you know, you could sell it for $6,000 pretty easily. But then you never know what's going to happen. That, I mean, one of the most exciting things about being an agent is you never know. That is definitely one of my mottos. I've seen books that have sold modestly, you know, just have surprising success in the marketplace, get optioned for film, all that kind of thing. So that's really fun when that happens.
So I'm also wondering in terms of what you take on, like how much of it is from a marketing point of view, or is it entirely from your own taste? I mean, will you only take on projects that you love, and or will you take on something that you go, you know, I might not love it, but it might do really well, and it's a good book?
Well, the love factor is especially important, I think, with fiction, when you might be, you know, I think the most publishers I went to for something that I loved was 40. So when you're going to have to be committed to something over a great deal of time, for me, how I feel about it is really important. I think that I size up other, not nonfiction in many respects is not, you don't have to evaluate it that way. You know, the writing may not be stellar, but it is adequate, and it's doing the job, and it's based on solid research. For self-help, for example, I like things that are kind of counterintuitive. I don't like things like the highly sensitive person reframed a trait that many people thought was something you didn't want to have. She reframes it into, you know, she helps you appreciate a trait in yourself that you might have felt bad about. I love that. I do not like inspirational self-help, where it's all about sort of feelings and affirmations and that kind of thing. That doesn't work for me. So, you know, there are taste considerations that even in that very commercial category are going to come into play.
So then a question that came in actually related to what you're talking about, given how broad your range of genres are, what is it about those books that you choose that caught your eye?
Usually, you know, with certain kinds of books, it's the quality of the writing. With my author, Maricel Vera, for example, she approached me cold over the transom through Slush. And she had the most riveting first scene of her first novel. The Taste of Sugar is her second novel. The Taste of Sugar is a really ambitious book that takes place in Puerto Rico at the turn of the 19th to the 20th centuries, when the Americans basically defeated the Spanish, took it over, were seen briefly as the island's salvation. And at the same time, there was a really terrible hurricane. There's one family story that plays out against this backdrop, but the echoes of today are so strong and so shocking. I felt really proud to represent that book. I thought she was covering ground that had not been covered before. Mm. Often it's the intelligence of the pitch that appeals to me, because you're going to be getting my attention in a query letter. Generally, I mean, sometimes people will be referred to me, or I will know them through other means, and they'll come to me with their project. But often you're going to be, my first experience of you is going to be through a query letter. And how you present yourself on that page is really important. Writing with precision, something that's well-paced, something that understands what agents are up against in terms of the necessity of positioning your book, of, you know, vis-a-vis the competition, you know, understanding that one of our first questions is going to be, well, what is the competition? And addressing that from the start. Less of an issue, obviously, with fiction, but a big issue with all sorts of nonfiction. And a certain kind of confidence, I think, that comes through in what you're doing also is very attractive. and the feeling that what you're doing is fully cooked, there, the desire to run things up the flagpole is understandable because writers are often writing in something of a vacuum. But the agent can't be the person who says to you, yes, this would be a great idea for you to pursue. We want you to come to us, you know, completely jet propelled about your idea.
I want to talk to you about query letters in a while, but you mentioned the slush pile. And could you talk about that for the newish writers who are here, what that is and how, I don't know, how often you might find something in the slush pile?
I think that the advent of submitting things by email has made agents more receptive because it's made the situation more competitive. It's leveled the playing field in some ways for writers. And we know that our fellow agents, if there's something good in the so-called slush pile, which is to say unsolicited material, where you go to my website and you see how does she want to be approached? She doesn't know me from Adam, but I really want to approach her. I work with a reader. Most people I know work with readers. We're a little overwhelmed by the number of submissions that we get, agents are. I mean, that's been true forever. A reader helps us winnow it. You need to trust your reader. I've had really great readers, most of whom have had a tie to the critical studies program at CalArts. They really understand writing. They sometimes have to be informed a little bit about the quirks of publishing, but they generally are very eager to learn about that, find it as fascinating as I do. So I think there is openness. I think it used to be thought that if you were going in, it's called over the transom, which is an incredibly old-fashioned term. But if you were going in over the transom, your chances were almost nil. I don't feel that they are almost nil anymore. At the same time, I think we all take on very few projects that come to us that way. So it's a little bit of a balancing act. But I do feel that agents are quite open to their slush pile.
What about other ways people get in touch with you? You mentioned you found Joy Nicholson through a journal in Silver Lake. Referrals, conferences, all different ways. Do you find clients all different ways? And is there one way that you pay most attention to? Or does it always come down to the writing?
Well, referrals can be really good. And because, there's a courtesy factor as well. If someone I know has taken the time to refer a writer to me, as opposed to somebody approaching me who I don't know, I am going to feel more of a sense of obligation to the person the personal contact who is making that referral. I honestly feel that there's not one route that is the best way in. I think that it is generally thought that personal referrals, because there's a little bit of a seal of approval aspect of them, that's a good way of going. But honestly, I feel that what you want to worry about is the quality of your material and the quality of your approach more than anything. Because I will often get things... I sometimes feel like some of the referrals I get are, I would call them, she's a nice person referrals, meaning me. So she's not going to bite their head off. And the material is not necessarily up to snuff, but I'm not going to bite their head off. And I can kind of see those like within 30 seconds. That's not the kind of referral I don't know if that answers your question.
Sure. Well, what about, are you looking for projects when a project comes in or a query letter comes in? Are you thinking this might appeal to an international audience and so I'm more interested, or do you, are you not thinking that way? Are you not thinking about international film, all these other sort of tangential things to the actual book?
Right, they're called subsidiary rights for a reason. To me, they're a little bit tail wagging the dog. I'm sure there are agents who think instantly about film potential. I feel that selling the book is the first and most important hurdle, not in any way guaranteed. And that if we can accomplish that, then many things are possible. Those other considerations don't tend to drive me. It is something that, you know, agents will think about that in terms of when they're saying to publishers, I am offering North American rights on this, because they feel that they could sell the foreign rights. But sometimes you are selling the foreign rights because the publisher is going to make you a larger offer if you're selling world rights. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that agents will weigh. It's really, you know, in a way that question is akin to, I am writing a series. Is that a plus or a minus? Mm-hmm. Because, well, could be a plus, could be great. You could be Louise Penny, you know, but we're not going to know until that first book comes out, does incredibly well, and you forged a real relationship with your publisher. Like that's the rather large hurdle we have to get over first.
Okay. So query letters, because that's ultimately, if you haven't met a writer at a conference or something, that's how they're going to come to you.
That's right.
So I don't know if everybody here is familiar with query letters. Maybe we can just first talk about why they're important and how to think of them.
They're probably the closest thing. My experience of them is the closest thing for you guys would be being, when this is possible, again, in an airport bookstore, looking at the copy on a book and having that influence your decision about whether you're going to buy it or not. There, you know, you're also going to look at, I always ask for the first three pages of any narrative work. So just as you in a bookstore would look at the first few pages of a book, those first impressions are really important, and being able to encapsulate what you're doing in a really intriguing way. And you can learn a lot by studying flap copy. That makes a big impression. When we feel like you understand how to pitch your book, and it's a very separate skill, totally different from being able to write your book, but it's a handy skill to have.
So, keep going.
I had a reader once who I thought put it really well. She said she didn't like query letters that told me something about myself that I already knew. Like, you know, if somebody would write me and say, as the agent for the tribes of Palos Verdes, blah, blah. I don't find, it's really easy to do research these days on agents. That doesn't tell me very much about the quality of the research that you've done into me for you to cite a book of mine. Although you, Barbara, you got a really interesting, and I thought nuanced question from somebody that you shared with me earlier today about query letters and how to begin them. And that person put that, I thought very well, that invoking one of my books, and it didn't fit in the category of telling me something I already knew about myself. I don't know if you have that in front of you.
You want me to read it?
I just thought that was a really good question.
Okay. It was Nicole's question. She said, there seem to be two schools of thought about the point of the first paragraph in a query. One says to explain why you are targeting the agent. That is, I met you at a conference, or my best friend is your client, or I'm a fan of your client X. The other says something that intersects with, but is distinct from that goal. From the agent's point of view, explain why the agent would be interested in you. That is, my work is similar to your client X, or you have said publicly that you like family sagas, and I hope that means that you will take mine, et cetera. Could you weigh in on these two ways of approaching that first paragraph and which you prefer to see?
I thought that was a very smart question. I like the second approach better because it gets us farther faster. And I think it's part of the confident positioning of your own material. So I think that that is a great way to go. Honestly, I think studying flap copy so that you can write in an alluring way about your work is one of the most important things you can do. Figuring out how to write about your credentials in a way that's relevant to the project at hand is also really useful. Having a paragraph in which you position your book, in other words, compare it to other authors who are successful in an intelligent way, that's also absolutely necessary. It's not as if, I mean, we're actually more flexible than I might have just indicated, meaning you could write something really funny and clever, and that would catch people's attention and that would be highly worthwhile. It's not like if you leave out the white space between paragraphs, we're going to get mad at you. You know what I mean? I mean, sometimes people get caught up in that kind of minutia and it's not necessary. We will even, I had an author who had a very complicated book and it was just unbelievably difficult for him to describe it. It was a novel in a paragraph, but he was referred to me and I went to the actual first three pages and they were so amazing that I didn't really care that he hadn't really succeeded at describing it in a paragraph. We are looking for reasons to say yes as much as we're looking for reasons to say no, if that makes sense.
What about comp titles? How recent do they need to be? How famous, or can they be obscure? Can you compare movies and books? Comp titles.
You can do all those things. There are ways of doing it persuasively and not so persuasively. And it's a little hard for me to lay that out in much detail in this kind of context. But I can tell you that the author I was describing a minute ago, who had a very complicated book that it was hard for him to describe in a paragraph, came up with the most amazing comps. He wrote a book called I Was Howard Hughes, and it was about a journalist who was writing a book about Howard Hughes and was so taken with him that he began to emulate him and seemed not to notice that Howard Hughes had been insane. He was an unreliable narrator. And so it was about the consequences of wealth and fame. And Stephen came up with the comp that it was like The Great Gatsby meets This Is Spinal Tap, which was like, I don't even know what, I don't care what that means. I love it, you know? And it was true. It was actually, that is very accurate, in fact. In the end, I would have to say that is very accurate. So many things, but you know, if somebody else invoked The Great Gatsby, it could irritate me. You know, I mean, it's a lot of it is really context-based. Same with films. There's a way that sometimes people will almost forget to describe their book in relation to other books. They will only describe it in relation to other cultural artifacts. And that doesn't always work for editors because the editor is really literally thinking about how are bookstores, you know, mm-hmm. what category, what, you know, what section of the bookstore is this going to be in? what writers is this writer going to be compared to? It's like sometimes we really have to bring things down to earth. Often though, if we like part of what you're doing, we'll help you sort of up your game for our purposes in the rest of what you're doing.
Novels, you have to be finished, I would imagine, to query an agent. Yes?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, Lord knows, you will hear about novels being sold for a lot of money on the basis of a partial manuscript. It will happen. But the problem I find is often people will not, there'll be a saggy middle, or the ending will kind of trail off. There will be some problem with it that if you hadn't written your all the way to the end and then stepped back from the work for a little while so you can get some distance on it and then return to it, you would not be able to see the saggy middle or the trailing off end and would not be able to revise appropriately. And you need to, because the bar is so high. That's certainly a headline that I have to get across, is that the bar, you know, at the publishers is very high.
What about memoir? Can you sell it as you might other nonfiction with 30 pages
part of it? Proposal? You know, I had the worst luck with a memoir that I sold on the basis of a sample chapter, which ended up getting canceled because it turned out that the concept that animated the book, once you started writing about it in a lot of chapters, came across as repetitive, which was not, I don't even think the author knew that was going to be the case. I mean, she didn't. The memoirs that I've had the best luck with, I've had the most material. I've had 150 pages or more. Because it's a narrative work, and the same thing applies. You know, is there a problem with this? Or might there be a problem with this? You know, the editor is asking himself or herself, the author doesn't have that much experience. They haven't gotten very far in this. Are they going to be able to pull it off? So that's why I like to see more rather than less.
So if you had 150, 200, 250 pages from a memoir, you wouldn't need a book proposal.
I usually like to have a little proposal, like a really concise one.
All nonfiction.
Yeah, about 10 pages, because there's stuff that you want to say. You're doing the positioning. You might have a marketing plan. You know, if you're writing something literary, you're not offering a marketing plan per se, but you are talking about your connections. And doing that in a proposal can, and even showing that you can write about, you know, the overview of a proposal is sort of why this book now, why this author, and showing that you can write about that, you know, write like fabulous 3 pages of copy about your book is very handy.
Mm-hmm. A question from Marla, is it inspirational to have a client with a novel becoming a movie? And were you Joy Nicholson's agent for the Tribes of Palos Verdes when it sold to film?
It was really fun. That was a book that didn't get a gigantic advance. Publisher totally supported it. It was amazing. And it hit some kind of nerve in Southern California. I mean, it's about a girl who surfs. And there was something about the zeitgeist at that time. She was on the cover of every, you know, weekly, LA Times, reviewed in Los Angeles Magazine. She just got a ton of attention. And it was under option for years and years and years and years, and then finally made into a movie with Jennifer Garner in it. And, you know, like going to the premiere of that at the Ace Hotel was so ridiculously fun. And they had right up front, it said, you know, I mean, its own screen based on the novel by Joy Nicholson. And seeing it get that kind of credit was very thrilling. That was a case truly of a little engine that could. And I love that kind of story. It was a beat the system story. You know, I was so happy that things turned out so well for Joy with that book.
What about film rights? That's another question. How active are you in developing film rights, or do you work with co-agents who are working on that aspect of properties?
You pretty much have to work with co-agents. And they range from small boutique agencies to, you know, WME and CAA, which have a lot of weight to throw around, which is great. I find that the more attention a book gets up front, which often means, you know, on Publishers Marketplace, I don't know if you guys know about Publishers Marketplace, do you? It's an amazing website, I love it. It's really great. I see somebody shaking her head, no. Publishersmarketplace.com has a deal report, agents self-report to it. And there's a kind of a ranking, you know, something is a nice deal, a good deal, a significant deal, a major deal. And the film and TV agents look at those. And when it seems as though something is going to be a lead title for a publisher, you can end up getting a million inquiries. With other books, you're sort of chasing down co-agents to work with you and persuading them, you know, so it's the whole range.
Caitlin, I think it was Caitlin, asked about on your website, you described the types of writing your agency represents to include upscale commercial women's fiction among other genres. What are some examples of that?
Well, I immediately go to the editors who handle it more than to individual titles. I represented a writer named Melissa Jacobs who wrote upscale commercial women's fiction. What people mean by that is, and I'm having trouble coming up with a more current example, although I think if you look at bestseller lists, you'll find them. Their genre fiction and then upscale commercial women's fiction is not really literary fiction, although it can have very literary components, but it's often extremely plot driven. Gillian Flynn would be an example. Plot driven versus voice driven. Often literary fiction is very voice driven. So, I mean, that's one distinction.
Another question, do you like mysteries and are they easy to sell?
Mysteries have become difficult to sell. I mean, there are mysteries and then there are thrillers. Thrillers, you know, sort of the bigger, tenser kinds of stories tend to be easier to sell. The cozier, smaller series stories tend to be more difficult to sell. I do like them. I really like voice driven, sort of voice and place driven, atmospheric. I think they've become more difficult. I mean, that's a change. I know that you were interested in Barbara, in what has changed over time. I think that that's a category that has become somewhat more difficult or somewhat more skewed towards the one-off than the series. And there, you know, there are some, Lord knows, notable exceptions like Louise Penny, mm-hmm. who have audience.
If that's become more difficult, have there been any genres that have become easier that right now are more interesting to editors?
I was listening to the people who do book scan, I think, did a recent Zoom thing for agents. And they were talking about which genres were doing especially well. And interestingly, graphic work was doing especially well. I mean, has done especially well. Like over the last pandemic year.
Have there been other changes you've seen because of this, what we're going through? I mean, it sounds like people are reading more, right?
No, it's been, you know, it's really, I feel like I've waited my whole life for this. I feel like I've been in this business that's been, you know, gently on its way out, on its last legs, like the whole time I've been in it. Or, you know, there are these very like sexy new businesses, new media, this, that, and the other things. And then publishing is just like poking along. One of my friends calls it the buggy whip business. And then all of a sudden it turned out to be this incredibly resilient business that thrived during adverse circumstances where the staff, it's like you barely realize that they're at home when you're talking with editors. I mean, I have to kind of remind myself, it's like, this person is not in the office. You know, they're giving me the covers, they're giving me the marketing plan, we're setting up a meeting with the marketing department, whatever, like all those things are still happening, but everybody's in their little atomized place. Somehow, I mean, there have been, you know, like the travel category, that has really suffered, that's not a big surprise. The fact that it has done as well as it has, that it's been, you know, that publishers have been able to thrive in these circumstances, it's like, it makes me proud. I'm just really happy, even though this, what a horrible circumstances in which to have that happen.
What about titles, titles of books? How important are they to you?
They're very important. I feel that there's like a genetic component to the ability to come up with good titles. Like I call it the title gift. And I find that either you have it or you don't have it. I have it like once every 5 years, I will come up with a brilliant title for a client of mine. But I often have to send my authors back for a new title and be completely relentless about it. You know, for the person who, where they say about me, she seems nice, I can be like, no, we're not there yet. Nope. And like 12 rounds later, I love it. You know, I mean, we will get to the place where we need to be, but I have to be relentless about that stuff because editors are going to make up their minds in a millisecond. And so I need to anticipate all the different ways they're going to say no, and try to head them off at the pass. And a clever title really goes a long way.
Another question, is it important for you to see an online presence of the author?
No, in most cases. Self-help is probably one where the better known you are, the more of a platform you have, the better. But every other category where it's really more of a narrative undertaking, nah. I mean, if you happen to be a brilliant blogger or you totally get Instagram or, you know, any of that kind of thing, that's great. Yay. We can take advantage of that. But is it necessary? No. The publishers have totally wised up. This is a really great thing because when all this stuff first came on the scene, they wanted everybody to do everything because nobody understood anything. And they've completely gotten over that. And they really only want you to do it when you're good at it. It can be a way of developing an audience. That is important. But you have to have a knack for it.
Okay, another question. When you read material that's good but not for you, will you send it to other agents who represent that material, that sort of material?
That is a very good question. Agents will not send material to other agents per se. We will sometimes say, you know, this would be good for so-and-so. I am of the school that likes to encourage people when I feel that somebody has made a really concerted effort, done a great job, but something is not for me, I like to take a few lines and give them some encouragement, possibly mention some other agents. It's a little bit of a mixed bag because when other agents refer people to me, I don't even know, you know, like 98 times out of 100, it's because there's a fatal flaw with the material. You know, like it's darn close, but there's still a fatal flaw with the material because otherwise they would have taken it on. Mm-hmm. And so I will often say to people, you know, I'm not sure that it pays to mention my name for that reason. But I will sometimes mention other agents, but I don't actually like send the material to other agents.
Right. Well, what about if you send an encouraging note to someone, you're rejecting the query or the manuscript, not the query, but the manuscript, you're rejecting it. They take your note to heart and rewrite, mm-hmm. revise. Do you want to see it again? Or will you only want to see it again if you ask for it?
If I ask for it, yes. If I don't ask for it, probably not. It tends to be difficult to revisit things. And people often don't revise thoroughly enough. You know, it can be almost like a cosmetic revision, and that's not going to end up being enough. I'm not even sure I can think of an instance where I took something on that I had turned down and went on and sold it. It tends to be difficult. It's not impossible, though. You know, things often take incredibly circuitous routes to publication. I absolutely adore those stories. Whenever I see them in the paper, you know, I sort of cheer internally. And you do see them where, you know, something was rejected by one publisher and picked up by another publisher. And I mean, there are all sorts of honestly incredibly circuitous routes. So, you know, to return to my original motto, you never know. Just because I'm saying that, right. that I'm not that keen on resubmitting, it doesn't mean that somebody else wouldn't be perfectly open to it.
Another question, are you evaluating other skills and qualities in an author's personality when you're in the initial process of deciding to sign them, or is it all about the work?
That's another very good question. I would say it's mainly about the work. I think that, this is gonna sound ridiculous, I think authors get a pass. In some ways, you know, I think there's an understanding that, you know, writers might like to spend quite a bit of time alone. and that's fine. I mean, they would like you to be able to talk to your, you know, like go to bookstore readings or do a Zoom thing, be articulate about your work, figure out, you know, given your own comfort level, what can you do? And I think you can do a lot. I remember when I first came to LA and I realized that I was going to have to do things like teach classes at UCLA Extension. And I was utterly petrified. And then I got over it. You know, I mean, you do it enough and then that kind of anxiety wears off. I think the work is the most important thing. Yep.
Another question is biographies. What about biographies? Do you handle biographies? And do you accept memoirs written by a pen name with a pen name?
I have not handled biographies. It doesn't mean that I wouldn't handle biographies. It's just that I have not really run across one that spoke to me. And I don't tend to read them much. A memoir with a pen name, again, would depend on the circumstances. Some, you know, a pen name can make it difficult to do very effective promotion if you have to be invisible. It can be a complicating factor. So I'm not sure. I would need to know the circumstances.
Okay. Here's one. Is there a point where a novel reads too much like a screenplay to be literary? Can it be too Hollywood? Or are there fundamental principles of an engaging movie that also apply to novels, even ones with literary ambition?
A very interesting question. I have some writers who write screenplays first and then novels from the screenplays. The risk is that the kind of thing that could be accomplished really quickly in a scene in a movie actually takes a lot more time on the page. And you have to be mindful of that. They are really two different things. That's the main thing I've noticed, is that sometimes the temptation to dispatch something important in an image is going to work in a screenplay, is not going to work in a novel. In terms of story, you know, that's a category thing. I don't tend to handle much commercial fiction. So it, you know, which isn't to say that literary fiction can't be commercial, but they are two different things. One being more voice and character driven, and the other being more plot driven. So certainly somebody who understands storytelling as it plays out in a screenplay has real skills to bring to a novel. They can seem, I find, the risk is that they will seem shallow and glib. So they can't. But you know, somebody, Robert Crace, who I love, I adore him, I think he's amazing, the mystery writer, started out as, I think, as a TV writer, and you know, is just like, was made to write novels. Is really outstanding.
Here's one more, maybe the last one. So if anybody has any other questions, get them in the chat. Have you ever had a writer use a pen name from a different or obscured gender? And if so, did that make an effect to how they were marketed / sold to publishers? Or is there a glass ceiling for publishing with certain demographics?
I haven't had an author like that. Let me answer the second half of the question. I think there have been glass ceilings, but I think that they are going away. I think that there's a huge awareness that there's a diversity of voices and a diversity of audiences out there, massive awareness on the part of publishers. And that it's really meaningful. And that if any medium is, or you know, media entities are capable of reaching specific audiences and are not necessarily having to reach mass audiences, it's book publishing. You know, so I think that there is real opportunity there. And I also think that there's a real thirst for new voices, stories we have not necessarily heard before, all that. I think that, you know, like, now's the time for sure.
And one more question. If you've self-published in the past, not a bestseller, is it necessary to put it in the query letter?
No, not really, not necessarily. I mean, it might come up in conversation, but it's not that relevant. I mean, it shows that you can take initiative, and that's a good thing. But it's not like you're trying to sell that book. If you were asking me, you know, I'm trying to sell a book that I already self-published, that would be another matter, but that's not what you're asking.
Okay, so to reiterate, I don't think we have any more questions. If people want to find you, how should, well, first of all, how should they find you? Betsy at?
Well, you should go to my website, which is www.amsterlit.com.
Okay.
And then you can see the sorts of projects that I've handled. And there's also a tab called submission requirements, which will tell you how I like to be approached. And you also want to do the same thing for the other agents that you're interested in. You know, approach each of us. Don't do a one size fits all thing. See how each of us wants to be approached.
Okay. Well, we've had you almost an hour, and you've been like concise, informative, articulate as usual. Thank you.
Well, you ask great questions. And you know, the main message I want to get across to you is that publishing is full of people. It's a people business in some very good ways, I think. You know, there's a breadth of taste reflected in publishing, and that's also really good. And you know, you should stick with what you're doing. And make it as good as you can. And then be very persistent. When you are looking for an agent, just be persistent, because there's an element, that taste element can sometimes get in your way and sometimes work in your favor. So you have to just put yourself in enough situations, put yourself out there, that you can tell the difference between the two. Mm. And good luck.
Thanks, Betsy.
Thank you, Barbara, and all of you.
Thank you for being here.
Yes. Good night.
Good night.
Thank
you. We'll be here next month, March 25th, with Memoirs Josh Moore. So come back. Stand out in the street and hold